Welcome to the WellPower Podcast, the ultimate biohacking roadmap, showcasing the brightest minds, research, and optimization tools across fitness, nutrition, health, and high performance, with insight and approachable methods to power your wellness. I'm your host, Kristen. Let's take it there. This is WellPower. Hey, it's episode 4 of the WellPower Podcast, and I'm thrilled today to bring you Casper Vandermeulen. I had the wonderful chance to see one of Casper's breathwork sessions and participate in it at the Finland Biohacker Summit a little over a year ago. I knew instantaneously that I had to work with this man, that I had to gain more insight and understanding about breath and also how to coach large groups, and really to understand how he could get everyone in one space so beautifully co-regulated. And I've since been able to take his coaching breathwork masterclass and get to know him as a person in the world. And I cannot say enough wonderful things about him. He says, I'm always relentlessly supporting him, but it's because his work and the dedication he's put into the years of figuring it out and then distilling information in a way that he teaches clearly and concisely so that your learning ability is at its very highest is almost like he's biohacked how to teach people well. And I think it comes from his background. He's a breathwork specialist and a biohacker, and he was a science teacher for a long time, and he taught students of all ages. He originally had issues with being overweight and burnt out and unhappy, and shifted his whole entire life and researched a ton to develop extraordinary focus, fitness, and personal freedom. He put himself through numerous experiments and challenges. He conquered the cold. He's like a infinity level Wim Hof instructor. He ran ultra marathons on his bare feet, tested countless diets, read a ton of science, and explored optimization modalities as any one of us biohackers do, but he really dove in deeply. He's gotten to be known as the breathwork biohacker, but he is so much more. He has a book called Mind Lift Out, and it really is a great read, especially if you're looking for something to pick up first, because the way that the book is laid out is not like any other book I've read, and it makes it just digestible, wonderful content to take in a way that, again, helps you learn. He wants to share the principles of self-optimization with humans all over the world, and let me tell you, he's doing it. I'm super stoked to bring him to you today to talk to us about biohacking breath and state shifting, just really to share the amazing pieces of the puzzle that he has layered into my breathwork coaching and understanding of the nervous system. So I'm here and I'm bringing him to you. Let's listen in. Oh, I got big news. I'm gonna take a sip of this. Hold on. Oh, you don't even know. I'm drinking Health Aid Kombucha's summer flavor watermelon, and it's like, when you drink it, it just sings to you. It's like, watermelon! Yeah, I'm not going to ask any questions. I'm just going to keep drinking it. It's so good. So what I wanted to talk about is, we are running a contest for the WellPower Podcast, and I'm super stoked to have gotten together with some partners of the show and to put together 3 big prize packs. These prize packs are worth over $500 a piece, and there's 3 different prize packs to win. So all you got to do is head over to Instagram. Make sure, of course, you've subscribed to the show, but then you get to Instagram like right now. Take out your phone. Just pull it out. Follow us at WellPower Podcast. Look for the prize pack photo, which has the instructions on it, and win a chance to win 1 of 3 prize packs. There is a Sleep Power prize pack that has in it a bunch of stuff, plus a chili blanket, which is an amazing hydro-cooled weighted blanket. It will make your sleep fantastic. There is a Meditation Power prize pack that is led with a Ziva Meditation online course by my wonderful friend Emily Fletcher, who just makes meditation super approachable. And there is a Flex Beam in the Red Light Power prize pack. Flex Beam is this red light therapy device that straps on you. It's super incredible. And you don't have to sit in one place to use it. You can wear it around the house and makes it super easy to get red light therapy at home. So again, go to Instagram. Check out the prizes going on this month. They're worth like $500 a piece, guys. So it's like, I want you to get some of these biohacking tools in your toolkit at your homes. Each prize pack includes a case of Health Aid and Blue Canatine and a book from Casper called Mind Lift and a bunch of Laird Superfood and just a bunch of other fun prizes that I want you to get in your house and experience. And all you got to do is hit us on Instagram, follow some brands, tag a friend. You know the deal. I'd love to see you there. And I'm so thankful that you are here. Welcome, Casper. It's great to have you here on WellPower.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Of course. I had to track you down for a few weeks, and I'm glad to finally be able to spend a little time with you and share your expertise. I wanted to start and talk about your origin story, because I've heard it, but I think it's pretty interesting, and how you came to be named the Breathwork Biohacker.
Yeah, it's not entirely by choice. Yes, I had a lot of, growing up, I had a lot of issues around anxiety. I had some very depressed periods, and generally, I was always in a bit of a mental mess. And if I say it like that, it seems like I had a very bad childhood. But if I look back at it, like, there was so many fun times, but there was always, I've had a lot of periods of pretty severe anxiety and some other, you know, every now and then I'd get a diagnosis for a certain disorder and there would be some kind of medication ready for that. And luckily my mother would never really go that route. And she would always keep looking for what is really going on inside and how can we figure out how to regulate, you know, to help me gain a little bit more control over my mind and my body and my results. And I had a lot of problems focusing, and, you know, I didn't do well in school. I always had some issues around weight. I started smoking very early on, experimenting with all kinds of substances very early on. So yeah, I've had a lot of issues around that, and especially anxiety, fear. I was once diagnosed with a fear disorder, for example. And yeah, I was very present in my childhood, in my younger years. And luckily, like I said, my genius mother, who's my total superhero, would always help me to dig deeper and to understand what I'm really dealing with. Instead of looking for solutions, we would look for understanding. So pretty early on, when I was like 15 or 16, I started getting very interested in the science of stress and anxiety. And actually before that even, we started trying all kinds of different things to help me get on track, right? So for example, when I was like 11, my mom would take me to a doctor and explain my problems. And like I said, they'd have some kind of, let's say, diagnosis and some kind of pharmaceutical route. And she was always like, all right, thank you for your advice. Now we'll just look in this corner and we'll look in that corner, and whatever would work, we would just keep. So very early on, when I was like 11, for example, I got in touch with some, like, applied kinesiology, for example. And they had some recommendations. Hey, take out these foods, add those foods. And we started doing that, and I started doing way better, right? So I was like 12. I took out all dairy and all processed sugars. That, especially that time, you know, this is like 20 years ago.
So cutting edge, yeah.
Yeah. Doctors would be kind of like, well, that's weird. You know, we gave you a diagnosis, do this. Nowadays, more and more doctors are more open to this more holistic view. So yeah, anyway, and then like 2 or 3 months later, after I changed my diet significantly, I would suddenly be a social kid and I'd make friends and I'd get better grades. So that perspective has been with me very early on. And of course, as a teenager, it's not easy to stick to any other interesting things and substances to get into. And I didn't really understand the underlying things that I needed to deal with in order to make that a constant. But I did have the perspective and I knew how to work with that. And then when I was about 15 or 16, I had a very bad period with anxiety and panic attacks when I really dove deep into science of, yeah, what does it mean to be stressed? What does it mean to have anxiety? I had this phase where I thought I was losing my mind. And I was like, well, you know, what does that mean? And luckily my mom was there to guide me. And she was like, well, let's ask some questions. What is a mind, you know, and how do you lose it? And all these genius things. So I got on that path pretty early on. And that led me to want to study biology. And I wanted to become a biology teacher. I didn't want to become a teacher. I wanted to study biology. But in order to become a real biologist, so to speak, I had to do a biology teacher training. And by no means did I want to be a teacher. I hated teachers in all forms, because those were the bad guys, because I hated school and I've always had bad experiences with teachers. And then, you know, I was like 21. I walked into a classroom as a science teacher. Well, I was an intern. And my mentor, who was guiding me through the internship, he didn't give me any slack. He was just like, well, all you want to do is like chill out and get away with doing the bare minimum, but you're just going to teach right now. I'm just going to put you in front of the classroom and we'll see what happens. And I was like, well, I'm not a teacher. I don't want to be a teacher. And actually, funnily enough, a few months ago, I found an internship report of my very first internship, the one before I was talking about now. When I was still in a pretty bad phase of my life, it was a kind of like one of the deeper moments where I wasn't doing so well. The first time I went to an internship, and that's when I figured out that calorie reduction leads to weight reduction. Or I read about that, and I was like, let me just try that. Let me just live off of 600 calories a day for a few months And I was, you know, I had some weight problems. I was about, at that point, I was about 40 pounds overweight. So I was like, let me starve myself and smoke a lot of cigarettes instead of having food. That must be great. Anyway, that was, you know, I was like 17 or 18 then. I went to this internship, and by the end of the internship, I had an official report from the guy who was kind of like supposed to be mentoring me. And it said, and I have it like black and white, and it said, Casper is not a teacher. He doesn't want to be a teacher. He shouldn't be a teacher. He should do something else. And I was like, cool. But then I still had to like finish the education because I wanted to become a biologist. So I had to do the teacher training. And the next guy who was my mentor was like, well, I think you may be a teacher. And I was like, well, actually, I have proof that I'm not. And he was like, well, shut up and walk into this classroom. Tell these kids about this thing. Talk about nature. And I was like, well, okay, if you don't take it seriously, neither will I. So I just went in and I started talking to these kids. And 45 minutes later, I was in the best flow state of my life. I was like, what's going on? I enjoyed it so much. But yeah, my lifestyle issues were still a thing then. So I was still overweight. I was still smoking. I was like a weekend warrior drinking and just distracting myself from the present moment. And at one point, I was like 80 pounds overweight. I was, you know, going at ramming speed towards my first period of severe, like being burnt out and a big phase of depression. And these kids were looking up to me. And I was like, why? Why would you do that? Don't look up to me. And I'm not a good role model. And I did well as a teacher because I was excited and I just tried to make it fun, but I wasn't a good role model of how to live life, or so I felt. And that was a big turnaround for me. I decided to really change things up in my life. And I got in touch with meditation, started seriously practicing meditation and self-hypnosis in that period, started to really dive into nutrition, optimize my nutrition, started to really focus on doing more movement, got into long distance running. And that's when it really started to turn around for me. And the biggest thing in there was that I would always optimizing my classroom. I was always reading studies about how does the brain learn and how do attention curves work and how can we, you know, teach relatively difficult subjects like science, like the abstract stuff like physics and chemistry, which I'm not a star at, but, you know, it was 9th, 10th grade level. And I was like, I can do this when I was a kid. How kind of like hack it so that they get better at it? And that worked. And then I realized that same kind of method of optimization may work on towards my own health and the results in my life. So I then started to ask those same questions about my own biology instead of just teaching biology, but how does my biology work and how does it create my mental and physical states and how can I influence my biology more consciously? And every time I learned something, I would find improvement in myself. So that's when I first got into biohacking. This is like 7 years ago. And every time something worked for me, I would try it out on my classroom. You know, it's kind of like hacking hacking my classroom with my kids, experimenting on them. And so I already knew this is like one example that I like to share. It's like, so pretty early on, I learned about stress and anxiety, the HPA axis, adrenaline. And then I was like, okay, so these kids just test anxiety when they have to do a physics test. I totally understand. So did I as a kid, still probably do. And all right, so that's anxiety. That means that there's adrenaline and cortisol present. What is the opposite of that? Oh, okay. So oxytocin. Cool. So, and I read this study about mammals, humans being mammals, having an oxytocin response to seeing cute puppies. So I was like, all right, let's try that. So I would have like a projector screen in the room and kids would come in and they were anxious and worried. And I would sacrifice the first 5 minutes of test time to basically force them to stare at cute puppy compilations on YouTube until their faces would soften up and their shoulders would drop and they started making these aw sounds like that. And then we do the test and then their anxiety was gone. And I was like, wow, that was simple. That was cool. And through that also, I got it. Like I read a study about lengthening your exhale, calms down your heart rate and take you out of stress mode. I was like, all right, let's do a little slow breathing before we do a test or before we do something difficult. And it worked. And so then I got into this whole, you know, optimization mindset, started practicing all these different things and trying them out. And yeah, I got my body in shape. I got my mind in shape. I got involved with the Wim Hof method, which then took off. I wrote my book, Mind Lift, which is kind of like a summary of all the different little hacks that I learned back then, which I'm very ready to write a new book right now of all the stuff that I learned in the meantime. And yeah, and then that kind of took off, took my teaching online and international. And I've been traveling and teaching and hacking and optimizing away for the last few years.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's wonderful that you had your own beta test group of kids in school to say, all right, we're going to self-experiment and then we'll see what happens here. I love that. I got the opportunity I first met you or I saw you, we didn't really meet, but at the Biohacker Summit. And so I've consistently had the opportunity to watch you work between your course and then how every time I speak, I see you or I speak to you or I'm watching you in presentation, there is a continuity of sort of what I think you would call the flow state when you're presenting and when you are teaching. And I just wondered if you could speak a little bit about flow state and your thoughts on how that connects either to the breath or to the body, because you seem to be able to touch it. So this is my perception, is that you can get there or you touch it so much more easily than I think many of us can. So could you talk a little bit just about flow? Or maybe that's just like, yeah, it's awesome that I, you know, that's my perception. So it's good for you to hear that.
That's good to hear. It also means that you see me in the roles where I access flow easily. And it's funny, whenever, and this is also to people listening, anybody you would study from or learn from or admire or look up to, they, like, we see performers in their performance state when they are performing the thing that their soul is meant to do, you know, and they snap into flow state. But you should see me Monday morning when I'm answering emails. I'm not a star. But yes, I definitely have a lot of access to states of flow through certain practices. Well, first of all, there is a general understanding of flow, as it's been described in scientific literature for a long time and in the biohacking industry, where flow is a very specific state that is measurable, so it's quantifiable, it's a neurochemical state, it is an electrical state that you can measure in the nervous system, there's a certain brainwave linked to it, which is very interesting. So it's a specific state you can kind of like point at, can measure it. And there are certain ways to get there, through breathing techniques or through some, like, nootropics or practices or even like electrical current stimulation, you know, that's interesting. And I use some of that, definitely. Like, music is a very strong flow state trigger for me and for many people, and movement is. What I find more interesting recently is not to necessarily focus on that state and getting there necessarily in that kind of like optimal, perfect, pristine state of flow that you can then be in for a little bit. But flow has become much more of a larger philosophy of life for me, where I realize that feeling shit, doing shadow work, like having all these emotions that we've learned to label negatively, having off days, all of that is flow. You know, so I've learned to see flow much more as kind of like, imagine life being a river that is flowing. Sometimes you have times where it's awesome and sometimes it's less awesome, but it's all the flow of life. And embracing that and letting go of all of my resistance to life events, which sounds easier than it is. It takes work and, you know, effort and a lot of conscious practice, but that has allowed me way more access to states of flow. Also, I think that the most important thing to do in life, because there's a lot of talk about health optimization and getting into a flow state and optimizing your mind and your body. But the question to me is, and biohacking is the same thing, like, what are you biohacking your performance for? What are you optimizing your health for? Because optimized health shouldn't be a goal in itself, I think, because health is very finite. I mean, every second you, even when you work on it, you do everything perfectly, it's still slipping away from you. So the finite gains, like health, like beauty, like money, like status, they're interesting. They're fun to play and they're an important part of the human experience, but they're all finite. They're all going to end. So the question is then, what are we optimizing those things for? What are you acquiring wealth for, or health, or, you know, beauty, energy, anything, or focus? And to me, my answer to that is to your soul's mission, which is a very spiritual concept to throw in. But I mean, I think we're all here to do something, and there are certain things that make you just, your soul just sparkle and shine and feel like they are your ultimate purpose at this deepest core of your being. So for me, I've been felt very blessed to find, to kind of like stumble across something that is my ultimate state of flow, which is teaching so early on in life. And that even though I was trying to get out of it, I was like reluctantly becoming a teacher, it kept drawing me in. And I found this thing that is my flow state early on, and I can do a lot of it. I've been very blessed to be able to teach a lot with a lot of amazing people. And even in the periods where I was, you know, in my worst states physically, like actually unhealthy, like years ago, or going through divorce, or actually being in like a state of depression, I could still always get in front of a group. And I'd always do that because I knew if I get in front of a group and I find that frequency to get on, that flow frequency, and I snap into this flow state, then no matter how bad my body or my mind are doing in that moment, how exhausted I am or jet lagged I am or whatever it is, I know that my soul will speak through my work that I'm here to do on this planet, which is my purpose. And of course, I've been lucky to have a lot of training on that in the trenches of the education system and make a lot of hours on being able to have the tools to do that. So yeah, that's kind of like my broad perspective on flow.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. And it seems like another, you know, another massive tool for you is the breath. And I feel like there are a lot of listeners who really are trying to figure out breath for the first time. Of course, we're all breathing every day. And so that's the interesting thing, is that it's always happening. But could you talk about some of your baseline philosophy about the breath? And, you know, for someone who's just trying to figure out how to sort of get control of it, why it's important to have some access to certain types of breath work and what it can do for us?
Yeah, so breathing has become kind of my main topic in the last few years. Again, reluctantly, people started announcing me as a breathing specialist and the breathwork biohacker. It's another long story about how I never set out to be a breathing specialist, but then now I kind of am, which is funny. The reason that I got into that, the short version of that, is because it works. And I was just studying anything that works. I was like, whatever works helps me deal with this human mess that I am. And then later on, whatever helps me help people deal with their kind of like human mess and be a bit more in tune with their human experience. And no matter what I studied, what I did, what I experimented with, I would always come down to, oh, but there's a way to breathe for that that is more effective or that is faster. So the great thing about breathing, and of course, in the wellness field, there's a lot of different modalities, a lot of different angles that you can approach it at. So for example, there's nutrition, there's movement, and you know, there's meditation, and there's all these mindset stuff, and like there's so much out there, supplements. And what I like about, what to me is so powerful about breathing, is that you're already doing it, so you don't have to like go do something new. Chances are, if you live a modern life and you have some discomforts in life or some anxiety or some, you know, you don't have the energy you want, there's a really good chance that your breathing is not optimal. So it's a very easy, it's kind of like the low hanging fruit. People who have low energy, have massive sugar cravings, have difficulty getting to sleep, have a hard time focusing, have a hard time getting out of their stress mode when they come home after a long day of work. You know, all of those things have one thing in common, and it's suboptimal breathing. You know, across the spectrum of health and performance, I meet people who struggle with the same issues, and they all, it's all linked to breathing. So a few things to understand about that, where it's so, well, first of all, it's available because you're already doing it. And then we have to become conscious of our breathing. We can watch it in the moment. A lot of people try to become conscious of their nutrition, for example, but then they're actually trying to become conscious of what they're putting in their mouth. And then they have their input, which is their food, and then they may have output, which, well, okay, there's literal output in the toilet, but I mean like their energy, their focus, the way they feel around that food. And it's kind of like difficult to connect the dots between what you actually eat and how you feel in the short or midterm, but especially on the long term, you don't really feel the results. You can't really watch it happen that well, like your digestive system. But you can actually zoom out and watch your breathing, right? So you can check in and go like, hey, am I breathing through my nose or my mouth? Am I using my chest or my diaphragm? Is it shallow? Is it deep? Is it fast? Is it slow? Is it rhythmical? Is it arrhythmical? And those are things you can always watch in the moment, and they will always tell you something about where you are. So if you're stressed, for example, guaranteed that your breathing is slightly faster, a little bit more shallow. If you're in a, let's say, bad shape, for lack of a better word, you may be breathing through your mouth or into your chest. You're locking up your stomach. And it's such an easy way to catch yourself in the moment and to realize, become conscious and to be like, hey, my mind state is in a certain place, but my breathing is also in a certain place. What if they're linked? And then you can do a little experiment. You can change some things. So like I said, the real, and it's funny because breathing is so mystified by so many different practices. And people speak about it in such giant terms, lofty, like vague, mystic terms, or overly scientific, that there's a few things that people are just missing that stand out in the literature, that stand out in the yogic sciences, in all the ancient breathing practices. And they're very simple. Like one of the most important ones is that your breathing rate and your heart rate are interconnected. So if you speed up your breathing, you will speed up your heart rate. If you slow down your breathing, you'll slow down your heart rate. Well, what is your heart rate connected to? Well, your mental and physical state. So if you are in a state of action, your heart rate will be faster and your breathing will be faster. Well, if you're stuck in a state of action because you live like you're a type A alpha dominant life on 12 espressos and a lot of sugar every day, well, guess what? At the end of the day, you're not going to be able to sleep because your heart rate is up and your body is still kind of trying to deal with all the imaginary threats that you've been posing it the whole day. And then you can lay there and like go into all of these infinite monkey mind loops, or you can watch, hey, my breathing is fast, my heart rate is fast, let me slow down my breathing. So the simplest thing, for example, is to just see how fast you're breathing with a timer, and then try to double those breaths with the timer. Just breathe twice as slow. And then again, double it again, see where you go. So it's such simple things like that. So yeah, the first one is heart rate and breath rate are linked. If you speed up your breath, you speed up your heart, you speed up your whole mind and body. If you slow it down, you slow it down. Simple. And another one, for example, is exhales are calming. And if you lengthen your exhales, you will have extra calming. So the more that you lengthen your exhale, the more that you will calm down. Another one is, as soon as you, so breath is the first responder of your mind and body, which means that your breath always has to respond first because your body needs oxygen for every vital function. If you give it less oxygen, it has to cut down on some functions. So if you start holding your breath out or in, for example, you have to calm down. It's the only option because there's not enough oxygen. And your body is genius. It's marvelous. It's magnificent. And it will just start calming down if you take away, well, take away is not a good idea, but if you limit the amount of oxygen. So I could go on about this for hours, but I think that that's a fair answer to your question.
Yeah, for sure. I think that this is an interconnected question. Lots of times we're seeing posts or little tidbits of information either through other people or on your handle about the time that you spent with Wim Hof, which are, you know, shots of you hiking in shorts in the snowy mountains. And I'd love to just hear a little bit about that. I know that you and he were close for a number of years now, but also just a little bit about those experiences and being in the cold as it coordinates with the breath, and just those times, what made you decide to do that or how you got there?
Well, funnily enough, I came across the Wim Hof method, I think like 8 or 9 years ago. I'm not even sure there was a Wim Hof method then, but when I was teaching science, I would always attribute like 20% of our time that I had with the kids for pure inspiration. And we just go on YouTube and we'd look at like people are awesome clips. We'd look at like amazing experiments. We'd look at human achievements that were done through science or through technology, but also through nature. So we would have like these moments to kind of like tremble in of life and nature. It was a very important part of my classes. Then at some point we were going down a rabbit hole of amazing things that people can do. So we started out with what's your coolest trick and all these kids had really cool tricks that they could do. And then we go like, well, what's humanity's coolest tricks, you know? And we'd look at all these different kind of superhumans. And then one that came up is one of the first documentaries that Wim was featured in. And they were introducing him, and he was like, oh, 22 world records. And, you know, they call him the Iceman. His name is Wim Hof. And I was like, hey, that's his name. So I Googled him, and it turns out he lived like 30 minutes from my house. And it was about 2 or 3 years later when I got interested in breathing and in biohacking. Actually, I didn't even know he worked with breathing techniques. I was just interested in biohacking. And I had a fear of the cold. I used to have a heart arrhythmia, and I just wanted to do something that was kind of challenging. Because a principle, another principle that kept coming up in all the stuff that I was reading and researching and experimenting is hardship. We need to do difficult things. If we live a life of comfort, the body has no reason to be strong and resilient, so it will never be strong and resilient. A very important biological principle, hormesis is the technical term, which basically means that a little bit of bad thing can be a good thing for you. And if you're doing a workout, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to trigger that zone where you challenge your body enough so it has a reason to get stronger, but you don't over-ask it so that it damages, and you also don't underload it so that it doesn't have any reason to be good at anything. And in the same way, if you never lift anything heavy, you never have a reason to lift anything heavy, you never be good at anything heavy. And we understand that with muscles, but the same thing works for your nervous system and your immune system. So I was very interested in working with the cold and with extreme cold. So I went to a workshop with Wim, and I also heard he did breathing techniques, which was cool because I was kind of getting into breathing techniques around the time I started my first little breathing practice then. And yeah, I walked into the workshop and I did the ice bath, and I thought I was going to die because I had this heart arrhythmia and I was like afraid, and everybody believes that cold water could make your heart stop, which is actually in many ways an urban myth. There's some people who need to be very careful, but of course, but in general, it's not, your heart can do fine. Like if you can do a 20 minute intense spinning workout, or you can do a sauna, then you can also do an ice bath. It's much of a bigger challenge for your body. Anyway, the point is that I was like, I'll do one ice bath and then I've done the challenge and that'll be it. And after the breathing techniques, I was like, all right, this is, I'm fully in. And like, this is what I'm going to be doing for a while. And then the ice bath came and I went in twice, and I went to him and I was like, dude, like, I need to teach this. This is amazing. Like it's meeting like spiritual and science, and human performance and biohacking, let me get in on this. And he was like, well, you can become an instructor. So I did train with him for a year. And then I started to work on some scientific explanations around the method and why it worked, just to help my fellow instructors. And that did really well. So then I started to help teach the instructors and certify the other instructors. And I did that for 2 or 3 years. I organized my own expeditions in Iceland, in Poland, in Norway, in a lot of cold places. And over time, I trained a lot of the other instructors, seeing amazing humans, amazing adventures. And yeah, I ended up, I think I did around 23, 24, like extreme mountain hikes and extreme cold in just shorts. Like I swam in ice water, I jumped off waterfalls. It's like all this very seemingly extreme things. But the fun thing is, it's not that I did it because I am a, you know, a young, healthy man in general fitness. I did that with groups of people ranging from, you know, a 16-year-old kid who's a surfer to, you know, a 76-year-old Russian guy who's just like a total badass, but also like sick people, healthy people, thin people, thick people, like men, women all over the world. And every single time I realized this, that the same principle holds up again and again, and that Wim very clearly state is that in order to reach that optimal state of human being, which is living in a state of flow, in a state of love, to be happy, to be healthy, to be strong, we need to challenge ourselves, and we need to challenge the things we believe about ourselves. We need to challenge the comforts that our body craves, and we need to introduce a kind of controlled hardship into our life that allows us to overcome challenges, because that is how humans grow. And I've seen that across the board of, like I said, all ages, all body types, all everybody, that it, to me, it's like a pure effect. Once you introduce in a safe way a controlled discomfort or hardship and allow somebody to overcome that hardship, that person will grow in more ways than I thought ever possible.
Yeah. And is there something about that too, in about that, because people had to show up to some of those expeditions in fear, and there's something about that, do you think, that's like the co-regulation community aspect that makes people feel more comfortable? Like, was there a situation where you saw, wow, this is someone who's shown up who is just on the edges of anyone else that would think they would never come on an expedition like this, and then they show up and it's like this, you see the arc of them transition?
Yeah, it's funny, about half of the people that show up in the intro round, they kind of like laughingly, awkwardly say like, yeah, I really don't like the cold. And then everybody laughs because like half of the people feel the same. Mm-hmm. There's always like half of the people who are all in and they love it and they've done the work and they just want to come back for more. And then there are half who's like, oh, I'm so afraid. The thing is though, that we go around our human life pretending a lot of things, like pretending that you are your name, or you are your title, or you are your status, or you are your weight, or the way you look, or whatever it is. And there's psychological patterns, and there's behaviors, and there's stuff you've picked up along the way. And there's like, you know, ways that you try to appear in social situations. And all of that is great. It all serves a purpose. It all has a function. But a lot of times, all of that societal and behavioral kind of stuff takes us away from really understanding our humanness, you know, understanding that we are emotional, spiritual, energetic, and powerful, amazing beings that are pretending to be something else. And especially socially, there's hardly ever a time in modern society that we are in a safe and social place, and we are also vulnerable. Now, if you never see anybody in a vulnerable state, you never see who they really are. You only see those masks, you know, that I just described, like status and color and age and clothing and opinions, and all these things are just kind of like masks that we put on. But what's amazing is, no matter who you are, if you come into a group, you feel safe in that group, and you have a common challenge that you face together, you get to actually see people in a moment of real vulnerability, because nobody is a badass when you first encounter the cult. And of course, there's some people who can keep the masks on for quite a while, but I always find a way to kind of crack the nut, so to say, and to build up the intensity to a point where you have to surrender, where you have to realize you are vulnerable, of course, in a safe way. And that safe is really the key word there, because if you are vulnerable and you feel safe at the same time, then you can have a moment of healing. So these expeditions, what happens there, and what I would really focus on, is to create a social setting within which there is a norm that anybody is allowed to be vulnerable. You're allowed to cry. It's allowed to be scary. It's also allowed to be fun. Like, it's allowed to be anything as long as you are there with it in the moment. And then facing moments of vulnerability and discomfort as a group, in that moment of discomfort and vulnerability, the whole group gets to see that the whole group is human. And then we meet each other at this primal survival core, because when it comes down to it, and you're like half naked on the top of a mountain, and the wind changes, and you have this wind chill, and you're like, ah, your body says, get out of here, this is dangerous. That's a moment where you can really connect to other people. Safety is really the key word there, and both actual safety. So I would never put people in a survival situation. It's always a survival stimulus that is controlled and safe, not an actual survival situation, because vulnerability plus unsafety equals trauma, or, you know, actual danger. So it's a very, very powerful thing.
Yeah, for sure. And I just speak to that specifically as you're telling that story. For me, what's really interesting is there, it doesn't have to be in the ice on the top of a mountain, I don't think, because when I was out in Amsterdam with you guys all, you have a wonderful Breathwork for Coaches course that you led for 5 days. I feel like I experienced that arc, that trajectory exactly with you in a very non-icy environment where I had a certain level of who I showed up as, and some of the biggest learning I got was going through the process where, for you, for everyone who's listening, it was like I was laid down, Casper was watching my breath, we put some different weights on different parts of my body to see how I could breathe. There's a lot going on in my head of the layers of the person who I showed up as. And as I went through that trajectory with you, just, it's very interesting to me that it's the same exact arc. I mean, now you're watching it either on your expeditions or in your classes, and it seems, it's very meta to me to hear you tell that story, because by the end of that conversation, or the end of that exercise, and then the conversation we had at the end, I knew who I was on the inside was trying to get out. And I had such a keen understanding of the fact that not only the person who I had layered as the mask a little bit, right, which is a necessary thing in life, or just, it is a part of the person that I am, but that needed to be pulled away. So even in the knowing of who I was, or who I am innately, and my most vulnerable self, I still could feel the battle of both the nervous system and the mental energy in my mind against, how do I let go of this piece so I can just really be who I am in front of this group of people? And that's exactly what you just explained to me. So that, it's really meta to have you describe that, because going through that process with you was something that shifted not only how I see breath, but how I see my nervous system, how I see my mindset as I walk into the door. So thanks for that. It was awesome.
There's so many. Yeah, that was a really special moment. And the reason it was so powerful is because you fully surrendered into it. And that's something that's very important that a lot of people don't really get, because a lot of people take on their fitness challenges with this very mental approach of like, I have to be mentally strong. I push my body and force my body. And I think in the fitness industry, there's a lot of unhealthy ways of using intensity and just loading intensity on the body more and more without really studying it. I think intensity and discomfort can be the most therapeutical tool for really doing deep inner work, and even, you know, processing trauma and doing like processing emotions and all these things. If you know how to use discomfort and intensity at a therapeutical dose, so to say, to really understand how the nervous system responds to certain triggers, and then to administer the exact right amount of intensity, stress, you know, discomfort, that allows somebody to encounter a part of themselves that they have been running away from. And a lot of the form that we take on, the mask that we put on, is not necessarily towards other people. It's also towards our own subconscious. And these masks, we put them on subconsciously. And the only way to really shift and to really change is to do something, to make something that is subconscious, to make it conscious. And a lot of times doing something scary or confronting can be a very powerful tool. And this is also, yeah, exactly like you said, and I don't even work with the cold as much anymore. I mean, as you know, I also founded my gym where we work with a lot of, with intensity of weights. We work with sandbags and sleds, and we do the same inner work. A lot of times also after retreats where we work with intensity, people go like, yeah, I thought I was here to like conquer the cold or to be stronger or, and all these physical things. And then they go like, oh, I realize now the discomfort, or for example, an ice bath. And in the exact same way that I did that, I can now have that conversation with my father, or, you know, whatever it may be, like whatever that person needs to face in life. And that's really where the power of this work is.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned the gym that you founded, The interesting thing to me a lot in the biohacking world is that I feel like there's an absence. It's getting to be a bit more and more with the breath and the mouth taping and the hypoxic training. And I'm seeing a bit more that people are connecting the two. But will you speak just a little bit to about why you thought having that piece of strength training in the gym and the way that it is was so important to connect the parts of your life together and just how you thought that served the greater community?
Well, so the gym I founded is called Move, Lift, Act, Breathe. And it was really when we started. So my brother is a national champion Olympic lifter. And we both rented a room in the same building. I had my room where I did meditation and breath work and mindfulness practice and ice baths. And he had on the other side of the wall, literally had, you know, just a bunch of people in tight pants lifting heavy weights and screaming, which was a fun. And they were kind of disconnected. But for us, they were the same thing. So then we decided to break down the wall, literally open it up, create a space where we try to blend them together. And now we're in a really awesome new location. And I think one thing that is really underestimated is the power of the body as, you know, our ultimate vehicle, our ultimate tool for exploring ourselves, our higher selves, you know, and that includes the big muscle groups, that includes the fascia, that includes, you know, the tendons. Every single part of you is there for a reason. And it's very important to, I think, to work on all of those fields. So for me, so I think a lot of people who are trying to optimize their mind and their body, and they're taking like 80 different supplements a day, and if they miss out on this one supplement, they get out of balance, or they don't. I'm always just like, you know what you should do? You just pick up two heavy weights and just walk. Like, go back to super simple and study who you are in that moment. And it's funny because Andreas Breitfeld, I was at another biohacking event with him. And he's like well trained. He has this amazing laboratory, and we were talking about this very same thing, and we both came to this point of like, I think a lot of these biohackers just need to lift some heavy weights, you know, and because it's such an important thing. And I'm not a meathead by any means. I identify more as a geek, and I was never athletic. I was always the last to be picked in gym class. But to really honor your body as the temporary vehicle that you have in this moment is one of the most important things to do. And you can do anything from a very egoic, superficial standpoint, or from a very deep and fulfilling and soulful standpoint. And that includes standing in front of a mirror, getting a pump in your biceps and checking out your abs. You know, like, are you doing that to honor your body, or are you doing it because you feel like you need to live up to a certain standard? Now, a lot of people, they try to live up to that standard for a very long time, and they're like, oh, I should look like this, and they starve themselves, or they hurt themselves, or they like have this loop of self-hate in their body, and then they want to go away from that. And then they're like, gyms are not for me, and workouts are not for me. I don't want to live that life. That is not for me. And with rejecting kind of like the external thing that they were trying to be and do, they also reject that very thing that could be so nourishing to themselves, right? So strength training is such a powerful way to make that inner change, to really understand your body, to know where certain muscles are in your body, like your diaphragm. Like, do you know where your glutes are? Can they activate when they need to? What are they for? Like, most people don't even have their glutes anymore because they always sit down. And of course, glutes are great for having a cute butt, you know, in the summer or whatever, but they're also a very important part of you, you know, of your nervous system, of everything you are. And that goes for every single part of your body. And I think honoring that is so important. And I think challenging it is a very important way to honor it.
Yeah, awesome. You talk about, maybe you would even suggest the strength training is one of these, but in your book, you talk a lot about setting these, making micro changes and setting habits piece by piece in order to sort of like build yourself up for the long-term goals. And if you had like three initial habits that you think, like maybe these are things that are built into your morning routine or your day, but if I was going to tell listeners, hey, here's some three small habits that you could think about to work into your life in some way, would you include strength training in that? Would you, what are three things that you might say are good things to self-assess and then think about if it makes sense for them to put into their day?
Well, for me, there's a few very important kind of rules for lifestyle changes, guidelines, I should say. It has to be as simple as possible. Unless it ignites your soul in endless curiosity, then you can add complexity as much as you want, but you will naturally do it. I think simplicity is very important. I think joy in doing it is very important. And it's funny because I keep talking about discomfort and, you know, fear and stress and those things, you can have absolute joy while encountering stress, you know, and I think an intense workout or an ice bath can be a great example of that.
Yeah, and I think we like to call it type two fun, right? It's like, it's not exactly fun while you're doing it, but right after, you know how fun it was.
That's definitely that, yeah. And there has to be some kind of growth, some kind of evolution. Now, one thing that let's start in the evening. I think one of the simplest things you can do in the evening to improve your sleep, which is such a foundational part for your next day and for your whole day, is to do a very short, like take 5 minutes for breathing practice in the evening. That's definitely one that I would tell anybody. And that breathing practice can be anything. Like even if you just set a timer for 5 minutes and try to keep your focus on your breathing without getting distracted. That's a whole thing in itself, you know? Or grab your timer on your phone and go to the little stopwatch thingy. And then for 5 minutes, just breathe in for 5 seconds and breathe out for 5 seconds. And just keep doing that. Extremely simple. Then there's box breathing, which is breathe in for 4 counts, hold for 4 counts, breathe out for 4 counts, hold for 4 counts. The funny thing is with breathing in the beginning, it doesn't matter too much which one you do, which technique you do. As long as you have a moment of breath awareness that starts you on the path. And from there, you can learn infinite cool things about breathing. But breathing practice in the evening is such a powerful way to get out of that stress loop that a lot of people are fixed in. Then I would say is pick up a new skill for the sake of learning the skill and growing in the skill. So for example, a lot of people take up a workout routine and they don't like to work out, but they feel like they should be in a different shape. So then they're going to go to a gym and they're going to pick up all these different weights and all these different exercises. And they're just doing all this stuff kind of reluctantly, which is of course a good step, but I would say learn a skill and even like getting really good at 3 very simple dumbbell exercises, you know, or learning a very simple skill like barefoot walking is a skill. Awesome. Juggling. Playing a musical instrument, learning, progressing towards a handstand. I mean, now it looks cool on Instagram, but it was like 5 years ago that I started to want to learn the handstand and I realized I had to start with a plank. And I was like, that's boring, but it's my first step on eventually getting that awesome, awesome picture for Instagram on the mountaintop doing a handstand, you know? And I think people feel best and when they learn and grow and also on a brain and nervous system perspective, learning a new skill is the most important thing. And again, 5 minutes per day. Keep it as simple as possible and just spend time on it. So like I've been learning to play the bamboo flute recently for like a few minutes per day. And it's amazing. It's breathing practice. It's great for my brain. It's like mindful. I mess up. Like I make mistakes. My neighbors probably hate it. And there's absolutely no reason why me, a grown ass man with 2 businesses and a daughter and like a busy life would ever learn to play the flute except for just me wanting to learn something new and enjoying the growing. And that should be the ultimate reason because that is self-care, you know, and it's great. And now I'm actually like starting to implement food playing into my guided breathing practice, which is fun. So anyway, and the third one would be take a cold shower. And if you're in California, it's not very cold, but at least start from very hot, cool shower. But if you start from a really hot shower and then take a cold shower, the contrast will give you that moment of like the discomfort. Even the moment before you take the cold shower where you're like, I kind of think I was going to do it, but now that I'm here, I'm comfortable. So maybe I don't do it. But then if I don't do it, I may feel, and then that whole voice. And then you go, forget about it. And just turn on the cold water and just go. I think that is the most important part of it. And then stay in the cold shower for as long as it takes you to fully calm and relax your breathing. And that's such a great way in the morning to start your, kickstart your metabolism, challenge your immunity a little bit to get stronger, but especially study yourself as you deal with something uncomfortable and something new. And I still do it. And every day, it's still an interesting practice for like 7 years.
Yeah, it's awesome. I always, when I'm coaching clients in the cold, I'm always saying that the anticipation of the cold is actually worse than the cold itself. It's just, you need to shut off the mind and just get in it and do it. So I'm glad you talked about the flute because that sort of draws me into the conversation around adding the handpan in and just, you know, the beginnings of your hip hop career and all of that. So we just talk a little bit about musicality and how it builds together. You know, you don't have to tell us about your next upcoming hip hop album or anything, but.
Oh man, I should have a cool MC name. That's like a breath worker. Anyway. Yeah. Music is, if you look at the literature, music is one of the most profound ways to just light up your brain in so many different ways. It's such a powerful thing. So I found music very early on in that kind of period that I referenced earlier when I was like 15. I was in one of my darkest periods of life. I found a drum, a djembe, and started playing. And for the first time in months, my brain just felt better. And I was like, oh, okay, so that's what I'm going to do now. It became my meditation. And it served me. And I just played for fun. I didn't know what I was doing. I was self-taught. And then apparently I'd gotten good at it through that process. And I started, you know, performing and teaching and trying to go pro at a certain point. So when I was a science teacher on the side, I was trying to go pro as a musician. So music was always there. I used to teach workshops to kids all over the education spectrum, so to say. So I would teach science for 3 days, and the other days I would go around other schools and teach, do drumming and do rap classes, like do poetry, slam poetry with kids. And I would work with severely disabled children and mentally challenged children, and all kinds of different groups of people. And I saw the same thing, which is as soon as you connect to that primal joy of creating a sound and then feeling it in your body, which is what a drum does and your voice does, there is a sense of joy. There's something magical happens. And I saw that everywhere. And it really taught me a lot about human potential. But then as I tried to go pro as a performing artist, I just lost the fun. It became an egoic thing. I was just like trying to be something. And then more recently, through a few very profound, I would say, spiritual experiences, it has become very clear to me that music is a very important part of my path, of my teaching. And I've been integrating it more and more into my breathwork guiding. And like I said, I've been reluctant becoming a teacher. I've been reluctant becoming a breathing instructor, which is kind of weird to say, but it's kind of how it happened. But I ended up finding myself in more and more places where people wanted me to breathe with them. And then I was like, all right, I'll do that. And then I started to implement the drums into it and live music. And more recently, I have found the handpan, which is an amazing instrument, to be a very powerful way. And the thing that I'm always looking for is what works. How can I be of service? And one of the most powerful ways to be of service for me is teaching. And then specifically teaching breath work, because it's such a powerful way to auto-regulate. And through that whole process, I've just found that next to breathing, the next most powerful thing to influence our state, to improve our experience as human beings, is sound, is music. We are built to be interconnected with sound. And one of my first teaching experiences was when I played the djembe and the didgeridoo. Like, I was that guy at the park. I tried to grow dreadlocks for a while, miserably failed, as you can see. Well, people don't see video, but you can see my shining dome on Instagram. And a lady asked me to teach her daughter to play the djembe. And I was like, sure, I do that all the time. And she was like, well, but my daughter is deaf. And I was like, okay, yeah, whatever. And it turned out that she could hear like a very high amplitude, very low frequency, so low and loud sounds. And I taught her how to play, make the right shape with her hand. And then at a certain point, she finally made a sound, and she consciously gave herself an auditory stimulus. She heard something consciously for the first time in her life, and her eyes just lit up. And I see this girl is still one of the most inspiring people in my life, because I keep learning, relearning from that moment. So, and it just showed me something profound about human creativity and about what is really our purpose as humans in life. Because we think it's all about survival and the Maslow pyramid and getting your stuff in order. But you know, when I was born and right after we lived in Western Africa and around tribes, so I've grown up around the tribal perspective a lot about the ancestral health kind of way of living and the stories from my parents and my grandfather. You know, we have this idea that if we feel safe in terms of survival and we have all of our stuff, we may listen to music for fun, and art is kind of like a byproduct of feeling okay. But if you look at tribal societies, music is the core and art is the core. Expression is the core. If you have no food, you know, you make music or you dance or you make art. If you are sick, you make music, you dance, you make art, you breathe. Every tribal culture has a ritual of healing that they whip out in the times of most extreme hardship and survival threats that allows them to connect to something greater than themselves. And I think a lot of people have learned that music is something you're supposed to be good at and it's supposed to sound good. No, you know, take a stand for yourself. Fuck that. Play the fucking flute because you like playing the flute. Sorry for the F-bombs, but it's like I get so, and you know, going around all these schools, I saw so many kids who had already been taught out of expressing themselves through their voice, through dance, through music, through all these things. And I think it's a very, very important practice to just do that for the sake of expressing yourself.
Yeah, for getting yourself out there. It's awesome. Can we talk a little bit about psilocybin, since you're in Amsterdam and it's totally legal there? And just in the biohacking community, because my experience, you know, is one of the first times for non-recreational use of psilocybin for the learning experience when I was with you and our team. And I just would love for you to kind of touch on it, because I feel like you have enough experience to really showcase the positive around anyone who just has like a misconception of what medicinal mushrooms or psychedelics for recreational use are thinking they're dangerous or scary.
Yeah, for sure. So I've been experimenting with microdosing psilocybin for a few years now. I live in a country where it's fully legal, and I just go to a store and buy a psilocybin truffle and experiment with it. And the people behind the counter give me excellent advice. They're really, really involved in making sure you have a good experience. Like I said before, whatever works. Like, I just focus on what works. If it works, it works. And next to breathing and music and meditation, one of the most powerful things we can do as humans in general is interact with plants and with fungi and with these amazing other life forms on this planet who have amazing, amazing benefits to us, which is another thing we've kind of don't learn in the modern world, is that you can have such a significant influence on your state of being through understanding how plants and fungi work and how chemicals work, you know. And a lot of people just take whatever supplements because somebody said it's good for them, and they don't really get into understanding why that works and how it does for them and becoming aware. So to me, psilocybin is across the board one of the most effective ways to improve your mental focus, your capacity, your creativity. And it's just a tool like anything else. If you don't use it well, you won't get the results. You can mess up using any tool. You can do anything wrong, and you can do anything in the right way. And there's a few things, again, that are super simple, that are very profound in their effects on your well-being. And then if you use them well, like, for example, breathing and psilocybin and the other psychedelics that you can microdose, that just work, and they just work. And what I have found is that I experimented with a lot of kind of like brain-optimizing supplements and different nootropic stacks and all kinds of different kind of like chemical nootropics out there that are all perfectly legal in most countries. And it would take me such a giant amount of experimentation and tinkering and figuring it out and reading to really see whether I would get an effect or not. And with a psilocybin microdose, it just works. I take it and I have a little bit more focus. I'm slightly more creative if I take a right mind to it. And it's just a very helpful, supportive way for learning. And also, I mean, at different dosages, you can have different effects, different things that you want.
There's also a lot of science behind it. Yeah, like there's scientific research enough now that it feels comfortable.
So a lot of people don't question, and they don't really read, and they don't really know what science is. So if they think about a mushroom, they just go, look, I just want to trip out on some shrooms. Well, there's like a load of evidence, 50 years old, that shows the tremendously beneficial, like incredibly safe, like way more safe than almost anything out there, and very kind of almost like healing qualities of these psilocybin mushrooms. It's just there. The information is there. They're available. There's like so many studies that show that it could be more effective than Ritalin or other amphetamines for anxiety, for concentration disorders. It can be more effective than anxiety medication. It can be more effective for depression than depression medication. These are not my words. This is like, there's studies on this. There's experts saying this. And it's all there. And instead of having to take a pharmaceutical that you have to take four times a day for the rest of your life, you literally have a mushroom that grows out of the ground. You take a miniature dose out of it, like a 15th of what would get you tripping. And you only take it three times a day, and it's more effective than most medication. To me, that's just like, well, that's interesting. That's the kind of stuff everybody should focus on.
Yeah. It builds back to the whole innate connection, I think, that you have with nature. It's awesome. I want to final question with you, but the first thing I want to make sure is that we tell listeners where they can find you on social and the web.
So best place to find and follow me is Instagram at Casper's Focus, KASPERSFOCUS, practice. And yeah, that's where I'm most active and where I most enjoy hearing from you. If there's anything you got from this podcast, then please let me know. Send me a little message. My website is mindlift.com. Those are the best places to find me.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, and I'll put all those in the show notes. I like to close with this question for everyone, and it's really just about speaking to your younger self. So if you could go back with all of the things that you've learned, your health information, the journey you've been on, the education, the knowledge, and speak to your 10-year-old self, one piece of advice would you give young Casper for living happily and well?
Such a hard question. I think the thing I would have needed to hear was, nothing is under control. It's impossible to control life. And that's the point. That's the good news. All of the amazing things that happened in my life went completely different than planned. And so much of my anxiety, my worries, my fears, my doubts, my poor choices in lifestyle were all based on the idea that I could control something, that I could control an outcome, that there is a place to go, something that I should do, should achieve, should have, should be, that is not who I am right now. And understanding that, like, this, nothing is under control, and finding comfort in that is such a game changer. And I think that would have been helpful.
Yeah. And I think it's really sweet because it also builds back to this very strong opinion I have about you, which is, besides feeling like a friend and a fan, of course, I think you bring out this innate possibility in everybody that you interact with and those people that you teach, whether it be kids or adults or people on the top of a mountain. So I'm super thankful that we had this time. Thanks for spending it with me. I will let you go so that you can run out and do something fun over there in Amsterdam.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here. Always great to talk to you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Wellpower Podcast. Please subscribe and follow us on social at Wellpower Podcast or Warrior Woman Mode. And if you're really digging what we're throwing down, would you head on over and leave a 5-star review? It helps others find us, lets us know you're out there, and from time to time I'll be reading the wildest, most wonderful reviews on air. Any foul language you hear on this podcast is not approved by my mother. And as always, I'm your host, Kristen. Be well.